It's the 25th of March, 1981. Heysel Stadium in Brussels is where Belgium are playing the Republic of Ireland for the 1982 World Cup in Spain. It's a free kick to Ireland, close to the right-hand corner of the Belgian box. Liam Brady floats the ball in, right in between the onrushing players and the Belgian goalkeeper. It's a great ball. With Frank Stapleton rushing in, he crucially gets his foot to the ball as Belgian goalkeeper Michel Proudhon dives down low to meet it. It's a crucial goal, and in a tough group, a priceless one. But hold on, the referee says no, offside. The Ireland players are irate. They ask the ref to talk to his linesman, but he's having none of it. The Belgians try to restart the game quickly, but the ref pulls them back to take the free again. The goal is chalked off. After the game, the Irish players tell the ref exactly what they think of him. Manager Owen Hand walks over to the referee, Raúl Nazar, and doesn't mince his words. "We heard about you. You're a cheat. You've taken money for Belgium to win this game." The game against Belgium would go down in infamy in Irish footballing history. The feeling of being robbed has always lingered and never dissipated with the passage of time. But it would be yet another entry in a long, seemingly endless quest for the Republic of Ireland to make it to a major championships. So close, yet so very far away. Hello and welcome to this week's Green Shoots, a history of Irish football with me, Caelan Kerwin, along with the football knowledge master that is Gary Spain. You can subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you listen to us on, whether it's Spotify, Apple, Amazon Music or YouTube Podcast and more. You can find us there. Share the show on your social media as well and help to spread the word about the podcast and, of course, Irish footballing history. So, let's get on with the show. Gary, we're going to be talking this week about international football. We talked in our last show about football through the 70s, the exciting era that it was. But I suppose give us a little insight into the era of Irish football, probably from the late 70s onwards into, we'll say, the mid 80s.
Yeah, so from the national team perspective, it was very, very much a case of what might have been. We had so many hard luck stories, and some of them were not hard luck. I think we were definitely robbed by referees, but some of them was just bad luck. We had some incredible players, but it was a case of not to be. And unfortunately, looking back at what might have been.
Absolutely, yeah. And if we start off with, we mentioned the in our last episode, it was League of Ireland, but we did mention Johnny Giles. Johnny Giles was the manager of the Irish football team at the same time as he was manager of Shamrock Rovers. So I suppose give us a little insight into the reign of Johnny Giles, and I suppose that kind of, as you mentioned there, that kind of hard luck story pops its way in again.
Johnny Giles, we talked about him in the last podcast. Johnny was one of our greatest ever players, arguably our greatest ever player. He began his international career in 1959, scoring a goal against Sweden. They'd been beaten World Cup finalists the previous year. Went on to have a huge career throughout the 60s and 70s, also with Manchester United and mainly with Leeds United in club football. And then he became player manager of the national team and transformed it in many ways. He introduced a lot more professionalism. He took control of the national team. I mean, prior to that, there was a selector committee that used to pick the team, and the coach would be told, do what you can with them. He insisted on more control, and even when he got control, he actually ended up resigning in 1977 and had to be talked back. And when he was talked back, he said, "I'm running the show. I'm the manager, and that's it." And that's the way it was. And he, unfortunately, in March 1980, having started the World Cup campaign with a win away to Cyprus, he decided to resign.
Yeah, and that's interesting. What made him resign? He was still managing. So was it dual commitments? Was it too much? Or had he just had enough of the FAI, the system? Or why did he decide to walk away?
It is. It's probably still a bit of a mystery. You might need to ask Johnny that. He was manager of Shamrock Rovers, but there was talk that he wanted to scale back. He was 39 at the time, that he wanted to scale back a bit in his 40s. But it's maybe the stuff went on behind the scenes. I don't know. It was definitely a mystery at the time, and he was definitely seen as a huge loss. I mean, we had started the World Cup campaign away to Cyprus. We won 3-2. It was an important victory, first game. And he was a big loss. He decided to resign.
Yeah, and I suppose as well, the other side of it too is he probably would have been, like, Don Revie probably would have been a big influence on his life. And he was a strong character, and he very much got what he wanted. So I wonder, did that kind of play into it kind of somewhere where, you know, where he was just, he wanted to be the decision maker, and he felt that that just wasn't perhaps where it was going.
Yeah, well, he was definitely, that was the case in 1977 when he resigned, and he didn't hide that. He resigned as player manager in 1977, and he felt he wasn't getting the support of the FAI. He didn't have full control, and there was too many people behind the scenes trying to influence him, pick the team, etc. And he was talked back, and I think, look, generally, I suppose I look back, and I was going to games at the time, and there was criticism from the fans. I was a young boy. I certainly wouldn't have been criticising the Irish team. He was trying to play football. He was trying to keep possession. And a lot of the fans in those days just wanted the ball sent forward quickly from the back. And it actually did cost us a little bit. We did lose goals, actually, as well, away from home. But it's... So there was some criticism, but in general, Johnny Giles was an Irish footballing legend, and there was nobody there obvious to take over from him.
It's kind of rare that you see really great players transform into being good managers as well. What's interesting about how he kind of played with the teams, and I suppose the balance, and it's an argument that we're probably still having today in Irish football. You can go out and you can play beautiful football, but do we have the players to not leave ourselves exposed? So it's interesting that there's that kind of argument that still kind of goes on even now.
It still goes on. And I mean, it goes on at all levels. I see, I'm not going to get into the game, but I was as frustrated as hell when a very bad goal was given away recently by somebody trying to play beautiful football. And without the players, and I mean, you have to also, I mean, it's the Pep Guardiola style, but you have to have the players. I mean, Pep Guardiola has the likes of Kevin De Bruyne, Silva, John Stones, etc. Players who are well, and a goalkeeper like Ederson, who are able to play out from the back, who are able to pass the ball, who are able to draw the press, beat the press, etc. I mean, at all sorts of levels, people are trying that, and they're not able to do it. And I mean, in some ways, you do have to cut your cloth according to your measure. And I remember the boos for Johnny Giles in Lansdowne Road in the 70s. And I mean, even when we were winning games, but particularly when we were losing, that fans would be getting on his back. And he was playing as well. I mean, he wasn't just manager in the 70s, he was player manager. And so you still have that debate today. I think there is more of an understanding. I think if you go back to when I was young in the 70s as a boy going to football, a lot of the football was long ball. I mean, in the League of Ireland, I think Johnny Giles' Shamrock Rovers team would have been one of the first ones I can remember to really try and pass the ball, to play. I remember they didn't have a big man up front, which was kind of the norm for most clubs. You'd have a big man up front, you might have a small nippy forward off him, and you'd play the ball up to the big man. He might head it into the net, or he'd nod it down for the striker to do. I mean, in Limerick, we had Des Kennedy up front, Tony Morris playing off him. We had John Delamere came in as well to take some of the brunt. We had a speedy Gary Humes playing off him. We won the league, you know, and it's that kind of football. Johnny Giles tried to, introduce more of a passing style. And I think it's fair to say some of the 1970s League of Ireland defenders wouldn't have been that comfortable trying to pass the ball out from the back, and the fans wouldn't let them do it either. And I mean, they weren't built that way. They were some fantastic defenders, some really, really great players. But you didn't want them passing the ball back to the goalie, passing it around the box. And of course, the goalie could pick it up in those days. Yeah. So you actually had a bit more leeway, but you probably didn't have the press as well as we call it now, you know? Mm.
That's really interesting, because it sounds like Giles is kind of trying to change the mentality and the system into a system that perhaps is very, very reluctant to change. In other words, this is kind of the way we've done it before. This is the way we've always done it. I don't need to pass the ball around. What am I doing this for? It's just get it up front as quickly as possible.
And I mean, what I should say as well, one of the big things John Giles did as manager was introduce more professionalism into the international setup. I mean, there was a lot of amateurish organization, players being stuck, flying all over Europe, being stuck on trains in the middle of the night into the middle of nowhere and arriving in the morning again. So there was, it was a very much an amateur setup, and Johnny Giles changed that. So that was a huge part of what he did as a manager, not to mind changing the style of football, etc.
Yeah, and even at that, trying to do something different in terms of, I suppose, the agony of the decades that had gone before, it didn't, while it might have looked great at times, it didn't change the overall outcome, even though he was trying to do something different and trying to change a mindset.
Yeah, and I mean, he will point, I'm sure, to bad luck. We talked about the 76 European Championship campaign, and I suppose it went wrong with that defeat in Switzerland, but the long journey to Kyiv as well for the Soviet Union game. We went on to the 78 World Cup. I mean, we have talked about these, but we had a fantastic home win over France, Liam Brady with the goal. And we were, well, actually away to France, we at 1-0 down. Frank Stapleton had a perfectly good goal disallowed. Had we drawn that game, we would have been in fantastic shape to qualify for Argentina 78. But we went to Bulgaria, and frankly, we were robbed. I mean, the game was 1-1 in the second half. Johnny Giles had a perfectly good goal disallowed. The linesman flagged for offside. There was a Bulgarian defender. You can watch it back. It's on YouTube. Coming out, I mean, playing everybody on. And they got a late winner. It's and I mean, there were a lot of stories around the time as well about a lot of teams having bad luck. In fairness, I think France were hard done by in Sofia as well. But there was certainly a hard luck story for qualifying for Argentina 78. Not so much for Euro 1980. It kind of fell apart on us after a poor enough start, I suppose.
Dodgy referees. That's not the first time that's the first time we'll come back to that in this episode, I imagine. But in terms of, I suppose, so Johnny Giles resigns as national team manager. Where does Owen Hand then come in for first of all, for consideration and getting the job, I suppose?
Well, first of all, we probably have to talk about, I mean, I kind of joke, but Sam Allardyce being the greatest England manager of all time, a 100% record, clean sheet. The same argument applies to Alan Kelly, because after Johnny Giles resigned, I mean, the favourite for the job was Alan Kelly. So he was assistant manager at Preston, and there was a doubt as whether Preston would allow him to double job. So he took the job for the game, home friendly against Switzerland. We won 2-0. And then it emerged that Preston wouldn't actually release him to be Irish manager. So there's no question that Alan Kelly, legendary goalkeeper, of course, as he was. I mean, there's a stand named after him at Deepdale, legend of Preston as well. But so he was the first choice for the manager's job. And he had it for one game and then had to resign as well. So Owen Hand comes in after that. And Owen Hand had been obviously a player and played quite a bit. the previous summer he had taken over as player manager in Limerick, and I know we're going to talk about this in a separate podcast, he won the league. I mean, it's fantastic season, did an incredible job, took a Limerick team effectively from nowhere to be League of Ireland champions. So obviously the FAI, that had come to their attention. So Johnny Giles had resigned. Alan Kelly wasn't allowed to take the job. He definitely was the first choice. And then it kind of fell to Owen Hand. Now, it didn't go down well in Limerick either that he was double-jobbing, because he was the player manager of Limerick and now was going to be the manager of the national team. So, but he did do both jobs for a couple of years.
Yeah.
So he had the job by default.
Yeah. It's interesting that you say that, because we'll have Owen Hand on the show next week with an interview that we've done with him. But he kind of said that it took a little bit of convincing for Limerick to kind of agree to this. And eventually he kind of said, look, you know, me being the national manager is probably kind of good for Limerick too. It gives us an image in terms of, like, you know, the national manager is still the manager of the club. But yeah, it did take a little bit of convincing for Limerick to say, yeah, okay, we'll let you double job.
Yeah, I mean, I can see it. I was seeing it at the time. Obviously a huge fan of the national team, but obviously as well as a huge fan of Limerick, and we had just won the league. And it was kind of feeling we're going to lose our manager, the guy who won it for us. And he was very much our Brian Clough. I mean, Brian Clough was winning the European Cups and leagues for Nottingham Forest at the time. As far as we were concerned, he was our Brian Clough, you know, and he was probably irreplaceable. So we certainly didn't want to lose him. And we've obviously, look, the national team job is a huge job. There was no way he could turn it down. And I think the reality is, he could well have walked away or whatever as well if he had forced his hand, but you'll have to get Owen's Owen's view on that. But he did successfully combine both.
Yeah, and in terms of him getting the job, is winning the league with Limerick essentially what gets him through the door, and eventually he does get the job? Is it fair to say that Limerick gets him the job?
Well, I would think definitely. I mean, Limerick was his first manager's job, and he wins the league in his first season. It obviously comes to people's attention. I mean, fine, he was a decent player, but there were other managers out there. And, I mean, Alan Kelly had obviously been a legendary player and had previous managerial experience, so, and he was already working across the water at Preston, you know. So I think if Owen, he wasn't going to get the national team manager's job as his first management job, so to even get it a year into management, still in his mid-30s as well, still a young man, you know, he was still playing, he continued to play for Limerick at least in the following season, you know.
Yeah, and that, I mean, when you say it like that, I mean, it's a meteoric rise, really, isn't it? I mean, from being kind of player manager with Limerick, and all of a sudden you're managing the grandest of all stages, which is your national team.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. But I mean, he had obviously done such an incredible job to win the league, and to come from nowhere to win the league.
Yeah, so he gets the job, and then what's next? How does Owen Hand kind of, I suppose, follow in the footsteps of the likes of Johnny Giles?
Well, he had one match to prepare. That was against Argentina, the world champions, including a guy by the name of Diego Maradona, who
turned out to be pretty good.
He turned out certainly to be pretty good. First time I got to see him. He was already being talked about at that point. I mean, he had already made an impact. I mean, he'd been playing, I suppose, about 3 years. He missed out on the 78 squad, being incredibly young. And I think it's Sheffield United famously signed Alex Sabella when they had the chance to sign Diego Maradona. But they might have regretted that choice.
Just a little bit, I reckon.
Yeah. But he played in Dublin that day. Argentina beat us 1-0. But I mean, my memory is the crowd was quite small. I would have to look up the crowd, but certainly there were lots of empty seats, etc., even though we had the world champions in Dublin.
No, I was just going to say that's quite incredible. I mean, surely I thought there would have been a hunger to see purely the world champions, let alone the world champions play in Ireland.
Yeah, it is kind of a strange one. They had played the year before in an unofficial international for UNICEF, if I recall correctly. But this was their first visit to Dublin in whatever, almost 30 years. I think 1951 had been their So, I mean, for most people, it was the first chance to see Argentina in an official international. As I said, they were world champions, so you would think it would have sold out, but it maybe whatever the marketing or whatever wasn't as good, because I mean, it was a funny one. We did get big crowds for some games in those days, and then other times played in front of small crowds, so it was very hard to know.
So his first qualifying match is the Netherlands, am I right in saying that?
Yeah, so the following, so it's the Argentina game was in May. He had just won the league with Limerick, took over as national team manager, had that one game against Argentina. I think we were due to play Czechoslovakia or something, but it fell through. It never happened anyway. So first game at home to the Dutch in Lansdowne Road, and we actually played really well, but went to goal down in the second half. Simon Tamata, a very talented winger, from what maybe a forgotten name now from the 80s, but he put the Dutch one up in the second half, and it looked like the same old story, but we came roaring back, and we had played really well. Gerry Daly equalised with about 11, 12 minutes to go. I should remind people that the Dutch had been runners-up in the previous two World Cups, losing the finals to Germans and Argentina. Mm. But Gerry Daly equalised, I think, with about 11, 12 minutes to go. And then, crucial winner, Liam Brady floated in a free kick, and Mark Lawrenson, with a fantastic diving header, scored a late winner. And that was a huge win, to beat the Dutch 2-1 in the opening game. Sorry, not the opening game. We had one in Cyprus, but this was the main part of the qualifying campaign. Mm. That was a huge win. It got us off to a fantastic start.
Like, this is a great Dutch side, though, isn't it? I mean, like, we're talking like really, really great players, all time players on this Dutch side, aren't we?
Yeah, no, there might have been a bit of transition. So there's certainly the Dutch side, arguably the best side never to win the World Cup.
100%,
I mean, in 74, it was a magnificent German team, so I don't want to knock the Sepp Meyers, the Gerd Müllers, the Franz Beckenbauers, but that Dutch team in 74 was just out of this world, and they played the football of the tournament. I think most people expected them to win the final, even though they were playing Germany and Munich. And I mean, in some ways, they lost it because of their arrogance, and they didn't just want to beat Germany; they wanted to humiliate them. They scored in the first minute, etc. But Germany came back and beat them. Now, 78, it was a lot closer. Argentina were roared on by fanatical home crowd, but the Dutch did equalise. They hit the post in the last minute to win the World Cup, and Argentina beat them in extra time. So they were in a bit of transition in 1980, but they certainly would have been expected to come to Dublin and at least get a result. I mean, it was still the Netherlands. It was a huge team. And of course, we will go on to talk about, we met them a few times in the early 1980s and what was to come.
So we followed that up then. We draw with Belgium next, but then we've got to play France away after that.
Yeah, so the next up in Dublin after the Dutch was the Belgians. So they came to Dublin, obviously a hugely talented side. One of the stars, if not the star of the European Championship, was a bald-headed small midfielder by the name of Wilfried van Moor, who absolutely ran the show, and he came to Dublin and he ran the show in Lansdowne Road as well. Belgium took an early lead, but they had a fantastic midfield. But we had Tony Grealish, Gerry Daly, and Liam Brady in midfield, and you don't get much better than that.
Absolutely.
And Tony Grealish equalised just before half time. We played really well in that game. The Belgians played really well, and we were happy with the draw. It was a good result. And we had left the situation now that we had won in Cyprus, beaten the Dutch at home, and now drawn with the Belgians. So, and then, as you say, later that month in October 1980, we were off to Paris to play the French. And as I said, it was a really, really, really tough group.
Yeah, and this is a French side. Am I right in saying this is a French side that would later go on and win the European Cup later, much later, a couple of years later, but still, yeah. The bones of that winning side was there.
No, it was, of course. I mean, well, first of all, they went on. I don't want to spoil the story, but they obviously went on to qualify for the World Cup with the Belgians. They reached the World Cup semi-final. They were beaten on penalties by Germany, and they were robbed. I mean, you can look back at it, but Tony Schumacher took out Patrick Battison. It should have been a penalty in extra time,
and yeah.
France should have won. I don't think there's any arguments over that looking back at it. So they got to the semi-finals of the World Cup, and as you say, they went on and won the 1984 European Championships on home soil. I mean, Michel Platini, there were some, Bernard Lacombe, Dominique Rocheteau, there were some fantastic players in that French team. So we played them in Paris at the end of October in 1980. We went a goal down, and Johnny Giles will talk about being robbed in Paris in 1976. Well, Owen Hand was robbed in Paris in October 1980. Michael Robinson, a great player, making his debut actually in Paris. He scored an equaliser in the second half, and he was chalked off apparently for handball against Kevin Moran. Now, Kevin said he didn't handle the ball. Again, it's on YouTube. You can see Kevin didn't handle the ball, but the goal was disallowed, and France did get a late second. But, I mean, it's one of the stories of what might have been in that campaign. But we played really well, and certainly unlucky not to get a point.
Wouldn't be the first time we got robbed in Paris either, in terms of the football. But we recover a little bit against Cyprus as well, though, don't we? We give Cyprus a bit of an expected drubbing.
So we beat them. 6-0. We were 4-0 in half an hour. They were very much away from home at that stage. They were the whipping boys of the group, and they were well beaten. And again, I don't want to spoil the story, but we ended up losing out in goal difference. And we can talk about Paris, we can go on and talk about Brussels and everything else. But one of the ones that gets forgotten is we missed out on goal difference to the French. We won 3-2 in Nicosia in March 1980. On sand. I mean, I don't think there was a blade of grass on the pitch. The Belgians and the Dutch also went to Nicosia and eked out narrow wins. I think they won by a goal each, or maybe by two goals. The French got to play on this brand new grass pitch they laid in Limassol and put 7 past Cyprus in Limassol. And ultimately, I think we missed out by about 4 goals. So, now, having said that, we beat Cyprus 6-0 at home. We were 4-0 in half an hour. We could have got a few more, maybe. But, yeah, I mean, nobody was thinking about goal difference that day. It was just a comfortable win.
I wanted to, because one of the goal scorers that day was, am I right in saying, was Chris Hughton that day. Ireland's first black player, am I right in saying that?
Yeah, I think that's correct. And his mother's from Limerick, so he's certainly one of our own.
That's fantastic. There's always, you always find the Limerick connection, don't you?
Absolutely.
you're like a local newspaper. You're like the Limerick Leader. Always make it local.
Now, unfortunately, I mean, I can actually have another connection in the Cyprus game, because Pat Nolan was a sub. He didn't come off the bench. One of the best players in Limerick at the time, and very unfortunate not to get a cap. There are very, very few homeborn Limerick-born players we can talk about, and I know Gavin Cooney wrote an article recently about it in the 42, and it's a sad state of affairs. We obviously, the likes of Don Givens and Steve Finnan, but they, even though they were born in Limerick, they didn't really come through the system in Limerick. So you obviously had the likes of Johnny Walsh, Joe Waters, and then you're going back to Alphinuchan, you know.
It's kind of a, I don't want to get into the ins and outs of Limerick football, but it's a strange kind of, I suppose, indictment of Limerick football that we just didn't, Limerick football just doesn't have enough internationals, enough star players for a city and a county and an area and a region as well that loves football so much.
Yeah, it is a sad indictment. I mean, it has to be, you know, we can't really say anything else and hopefully this will change.
Yeah, hopefully. This qualifying campaign then for the 82 World Cup, we have to go play Belgium away then in March 81.
Yeah, look, this is one. I mean, you can talk about bad luck and you can talk about bad refereeing decisions and the hard luck stories in Paris, whether it's 76 or 80. And in 2009, this to me was the greatest injustice of all time. And you can get old hand to talk about it. And I mean,
he did. And he threw in a few expletives in there too.
He did. And I mean, as I'm sure he will say himself, he should have been banned by UEFA for about a decade by what he called the referee after the game. and I mean, he wasn't reported. And I mean, it's one, I'll put it to you this way. If you ask any Irish football fan from the 1980s, name someone who refereed an Irish game. I mean, the name would be Raul Nazare, the Portuguese referee, because I would struggle to name too many more referees from our games in the 1980s. But I will never forget that man. And first of all, we played incredibly well. We were the better team. We had a perfectly good goal chalked off. We were heading for a 0-0 draw we didn't deserve in that we should have beaten them. And with about a couple of minutes to go, Eric Harrits dived outside the box. The ref gives a free kick. And I think, was it Cullimans or Vandenberg was leaning on Seamus McDonough as they headed in the winner. And I mean, own hand went berserk afterwards. He believed he called the referee an effing cheat or whatever else he didn't say. And amazingly, he wasn't reported because, I mean, if you go out in a League of Ireland referee today or an international referee and the manager calls them what Owen Hand calls them, they would be irate. They would, and rightly so. I'm not justifying it.
Oh, yeah.
They would be rightly offended and they would report you to UEFA or to the FAI, wherever is the appropriate body, and there would be a hefty suspension because, I mean, I wouldn't doubt the honesty of any League of Ireland referee or any referee today. And what I should say as an add-on to that is a few years, about a decade after that, UEFA imposed punishment on Anderlecht. Now, they didn't do anything to the Royal Belgian FA and there was no comeback after that game. But about a decade later, Anderlecht were found to have been bribing referees at the time. And there was a European tie against Nottingham Forest, which was, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, that was the referees were bribed. And, all I'm saying, I better not say anymore. I'll let Owen tell the story.
Was there a familiar name on the list?
Well, I don't think he was involved in the Anderlecht, but I think my point would be if the people involved in Anderlecht, who were the leading club in Belgium, if they were bribing referees, they may well have been doing it in their position with the Royal Belgian Football Association as well. What I should say as well is Mickey Walsh was playing in Portugal at the time. He was with Porto. And Mickey had actually, I believe, had said it to Owen before the game that the referee did have a bit of a reputation in Portugal as well. So I think he was proved right. So whatever about the goal difference, the goal in Paris, I mean, some of those can just be bad luck, bad refereeing decisions or whatever. I think we were done in Brussels in 1981. And to me, it remains the greatest injustice It was far, far worse than Paris in 09. I mean, that was an onsighted referee, unfortunately, with a catastrophic error. But I would not in any way question the honesty of the Swedish referee in Paris. It was just unfortunately missed. But in Brussels in 81 was absolutely an injustice. And had we even got the draw there, not to mind the win, with other results, we missed out on goal difference. We were a point behind the Belgians, two were to qualify. That we finished ahead of the Dutch, and that was it. Ultimately, to prove decisive, although there was still a lot of football to be played.
Yeah, just kind of connected with that in terms of what you were saying. I remember reading that basically those kind of, shall we say, strange refereeing decisions tended to happen to smaller kind of nation countries, because they could kick up less of a fuss that would gain less of a spotlight, and so therefore it could be kind of easily kind of, you know, brushed aside in terms of those kind of things as well, which is deeply unfortunate. But I suppose if we go on for the rest of the campaign, then this is it fair to say we made a good fist of it after that, besides the disappointing result in Belgium?
Yeah, so absolutely. I mean, so we had a bit of an end of season tour, but maybe worth mentioning, Paki Bonner made his debut in Poland, but the results didn't go so well. We played West Germany B in Bremen while they were playing Brazil, I think. It mightn't have been the same night, but it was around a day before, a day afterwards, they were playing Brazil, and they sent a B team up to Bremen to beat us 3-0. So that was a bit embarrassing, but we also got stuffed in Bitgosh as well, if I remember rightly. Yeah. But the following season, then 81-82, we played the Dutch away in September 1981. So we were still very much in the hunt, and it was actually my first away game. Following my dad and my brother and myself, we went overland because flights were incredibly expensive in those days. So we went from Limerick to Rotterdam via boat and train. And one thing that struck me, actually, it stayed with me to this day, was the number of Irish fans we picked up in London en route. Wow. And they've always been fantastic supporters. I was actually a bit surprised to discover a few years later the London Supporters Club hadn't been formed at that stage. But I think we had about 5,000 fans in Rotterdam. And I think it felt like about half of them came from London. And so fantastic support. We were behind twice against that great Dutch team, and Frank Stapleton and Michael Robinson equalised. We got a brilliant 2-2 draw, and we were very, very much alive when the French came to Dublin a month later.
I suppose give us a little insight into the journey, by the way, because we've talked about it briefly on the show before, in terms of, you know, what travel was like. You know, there was no Ryanair, so you couldn't just jump on a cheap flight and get somewhere in Europe. So, like, a boat to Rotterdam, what's that like? 8, 10 hours, 12 hours?
It was over 24 hours traveling.
What?
So my memory is my dad drove to Dublin and left the car in Dublin. I don't think we got the train from Limerick to Dublin. I could be wrong on that. Maybe my dad and my brother will remember exactly, but we got on a boat in Dunleary to Holyhead, and then we would have got on a train in Holyhead to London. And I know we had a few hours, so that was an overnight train a boat late at night into Holyhead in the small hours of the morning. We had a couple of hours in London. I remember eating in a caff, as it was called then, in the East End. One of those old traditional Cockney cafes.
Yeah, yeah.
So then we got another train from London to Harwich, and we got a ferry then from Harwich to the Hook of Holland, and that was during the daytime. So we arrived, then got a train to Amsterdam, and then got a train to Rotterdam for the match. We were actually staying in Amsterdam, I think, the night of the game. And had to repeat the whole journey. So we didn't have much time actually. We only had a few hours. I don't think we did any sightseeing as such. We only had a few hours in the Netherlands, and we were back again, another 24 hours going back. But travel was very different in those days. As you said, there was no Ryanair. Flying was expensive. Mm. It was really, really expensive to fly to Gabe. So it was a lot cheaper to go over land. And I mean, what was I at the time? I was still 14. I was just about to turn 15. It was an adventure.
Oh, it was absolutely. Just, I'd say it was extraordinary, was it?
Yeah, it was amazing. It was a brilliant atmosphere. We had so many fans. I mean, it was Irish everywhere. There were so many of us going together that we didn't know each other, but it is typical any Irish away game. The fans, you'll never be alone, you know? Mm.
Yeah, I think that's an extraordinary thing about the story, isn't it? I mean, you kind of, one of the great things about away days is you pick up your own, don't you, along the way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've traveled on my own sometimes, and I mean, plenty of people will travel on their own. You'll end up in groups. You'll meet people. Don't ever be afraid to travel alone to an Irish game. You'll meet people with a common purpose, etc. And I mean, a lot of us will look back and talk about the great days, but I certainly wouldn't fancy today doing an overland trip to the Netherlands. But I mean, having said that, I mean, it wasn't. I mean, people did a lot worse. I mean, I know guys, Tony from Hospital County Limerick and Jerry, sadly, is no longer with us. They went by bus, Slattery's bus, to Switzerland in 1975.
Jeez.
So it went even further than that. I mean, I know of people who went overland to Bulgaria in 1977.
Good God.
It took them 2 weeks, you know, there and back. So it's.
What did you do for your holiday? Oh, I was on a bus for 2 weeks.
So, and I mean, these were the Slattery's bus to Switzerland was I think it took about a week. That was a scheduled trip to follow Ireland away. I mean, that was because the cost of the flight in those days would have been horrendous. Now, I mean, people did fly, don't get me wrong. I mean, people were flying to away games in Spain in the 60s, but a lot of the travel in the 50s, even go back to, I went back to 49, I talked about that in the previous podcast, and the late, great John Wilkes was one of the people that went on the packet to the game at Goodison Park. But people went by boat in 57 to Wembley, to Hampden Park in 61. And overland, people were going to Paris in 73, Paris in 76, it said Switzerland 75, the French game in 1980, the Belgian game in 81. We brought large number of fans went, and most of them went overland because, relatively speaking, the cost of flying in those days was horrendous.
Yeah, extraordinary. So we bring, or we have France back in Dublin. Big crowd comes to see us play. It's a great performance, isn't it?
It's a great performance. It's a fantastic win. It's a fantastic atmosphere. Three goals in the first half. I mean, Mahout put into his own net under pressure from Frank Stapleton. I think Frank might still try and claim it. But I mean, the crowd would certainly help. Frank got another one. Michael Robinson scored. We beat them 3-2. I shouldn't forget Seamus McDonough making an absolute world-class save to keep it at 3-2 at the death. And I mean, as I said, it was a top French team that went on to reach the semi-finals of that World Cup. Mm. And it was a huge win. We still had big chances of qualifying for the World Cup at that stage, even though our camp, because the rules were different in those days and the games were played when you could, and there was no organization to make everyone play together on the last day at the same time.
Mm.
So we had finished our games in October 1981, but the French still had to play two matches.
Ah.
And it actually reached the stage, and this game was carried live on RT television because it was so important, that France were playing the Netherlands in Paris in November 1980. Now, I think they hadn't played Cyprus at this stage, but the Cyprus game was going to be a formality. So it was as simple as this. If the French won, they went to the World Cup. If the Dutch won, they went to the World Cup. And if they drew, we went to the World Cup. So it, really, we had a great chance. And I mean, the whole country was glued to this game. And unfortunately, the French won. I think they won 2-0 in the end. But yeah, we were still roaring the Dutch on at 1-0. There was still a chance. I mean, that was the Dutch team that had been runners-up in the previous tournaments. They obviously felt they had a chance of going to Paris and winning. Or obviously, in our case, if they got to equalise, both teams might have been chasing the winner. But had it ended in a draw, we would have qualified. Unfortunately, it was not to be. And there was no Gary McKay, so we ended up disappointed, and the French and the Belgians qualified for the World Cup.
And I've got the group, the final group tally here in front of me, and we were so close. I mean, we're level on points with France, and it's that big win for France and Cyprus that really gets them over the line, isn't it? Do you know what I mean? Like, their goal difference is plus 12, ours is plus 6, so it's agonizing, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I do make the point. We can go on about Raul Nazario. We can go on about Michael Robinson's goal being disallowed. But the 7 goals on grass and Limassol, as opposed to the 3-2 win on sand in Nicosia, that also made a difference, you know. But it was not to be. And look, you can talk to Owen about it. I'm sure it hurts him a hell of a lot more than it hurts me. But it's definitely one that got away. I mean, the players we had at that time, we had David O'Leary, Liam Brady, Mark Lawrence, and Frank Stapleton, Jerry Daly, Tony Grealish, Jerry Payton, and then Jim McDonough in goal. Davy Langan, how can I forget Davy Langan? What a player. We had so many quality players. We would have done damage in that World Cup. We would have done well in Spain. I'm absolutely convinced of it. And just another thing to mention, actually, that the FAI did. I think it was the France game, but there was a rule in UEFA that you could force the release of players, because a lot of games in England happened at the same time. And if you go back into the 70s, we were missing key players. And I talked on a previous podcast about Paddy Mulligan and the 10 League of Ireland players in Linz in 71. But the FAI enforced the release of players in 1980 for that campaign. I think it might have been for France away was the first time it was done. So the likes of Arsenal, Birmingham, etc. were playing matches, but the FAI insisted that the likes of Liam Brady, Liam Brady would have been at Juventus in those days, but the players that were at Arsenal and whoever else, that the FAI insisted that they were released, and they were released for those games. Now, ultimately, I suppose we didn't qualify, but it did give us our best chance of having our best players available as per UEFA rules at the time.
Yeah, I think I read somewhere that Johnny Giles kind of insisted on matching Ireland matches with England matches or something like that, so that they would, so it was easier for the clubs to release the players to us, to the Irish national team to play. Is there something in that?
No, I think there was, because there wasn't so many international windows at the time. And I mean, I know, for example, I talked about the trip back from the Netherlands. England were playing in Norway the same night, and that was the famous 2-1 win for Norway. So we may have had a few chances about that coming back through London, etc. But I think Johnny did try and play with England. But if my memory serves me correctly, that France game was outside of the normal international regular games. I could be proven wrong on this by the facts, of course, but I think we kind of played standalone. But it did make a lot of sense to match up with England games, because it's less likely that there would be club games. Not always there were club games at the same time as some of the English fixtures as well, but it was less of an issue. If England were playing, we were more likely to have more players available.
Oh, yeah, okay. So we agonizingly miss out on a chance to go to the 1982 World Cup. And then, is it fair to say we go into the most famous or infamous tour that possibly Irish football, international football, has ever undertaken, because I can think of no other or have seen no other tour that has had as much column inches, books, or any other kind of commentary talked about it.
I mean, we've had a few controversial, I suppose. You go back to South American tours. I mean, I talked about the Brazilian Independence Cup in 1972 when we finally got a win after 5 years. The 1974 tour, Eamon Dunn, I mean, I think it's fair to say footballers in the 70s and 80s may not have been that politically aware, but we did go to Pinochet's Chile, which was very, very unpopular at the time, and Eamon Dunphy did kick up a huge fuss. In 1982, we embarked on a South American tour, and I mean, Liam Brady, a lot of players pulled out. Liam Brady did go on the tour, and a few people complained about the amateur organization, the number of flights involved. I mean, Owen was there, he'd be much better able to talk about it. I mean, we look back as fans. I'd love to follow the national team to South America. I don't think any fans went in those days. I don't know of any fans who went on any of those South American trips. I think if we went today,
needed about 14 weeks to spare, did you?
You probably did, in about 14 flights as well. So we played Chile. We lost 1-0 in Chile, which was okay. We lost the game, but that's certainly by no means embarrassing to go away to lose in Santiago. But then we played Brazil, and I think it was meant to be their send off game, I think, for the 82 World Cup. And I should point out that Brazilian team. I talked about the Dutch team in the 70s being one of the best teams never to win the World Cup. The other team in that argument would probably be Brazil in 1982.
Yeah, 100%.
I mean, I remember watching that World Cup on television, and there were some fantastic players. The likes of Zico, Socrates, Eder, etc. Wonderful, wonderful players. And they were beaten, admittedly, by an amazing Italian side as well, who beat them 3-2 in an incredible game, and went on to win the World Cup, obviously. But their send-off game was in a place called Uberlandia. Good luck finding that on a map. But they beat us 7-0. And it was considered quite embarrassing at the time to lose. Not so much to lose to Brazil, but to lose by 7 goals was quite embarrassing. A record defeat, of course. It remains a record defeat for an Irish side. But I suppose in some ways it got even worse. But go on.
No, I just want to talk before we get to the even worse part. Is it fair to say so there's obviously an argument that the organization leading into it wasn't that great. There's fingers pointed at the FAI. Players are tired. They arrive in South America. They're getting a lot of heat from back home as well for playing Chile as well, which was, if we're being blunt, a murderous kind of regime that was happening in Chile at the time. So it's not a great camp, is it? It's not a great place. It's not a great headspace if you're a player either, is it?
No, and if I remember correctly, and I may get the timeline of this wrong, I am going from my memory, so please forgive me. But we were actually, so it was also the time of the Falklands War. So war had broken out in the Falklands in 1982 when Argentina had invaded the Falkland Islands.
Yeah, yeah.
We were due to play Argentina on that tour as well. So, and I think part of the issue were, I think we might have even flown through Buenos Aires. I can't remember. Owen will give you a lot more details and a lot of the stuff around the whole tour was shambolic, and the number of flights involved and arriving in the middle of the night, etc. But I think we were due to play Argentina as well. So there was a lot of controversy. Obviously, all our players were playing pretty much. Liam was in Italy. Most of our players were in English clubs. And it would have been hugely controversial had we played at Argentina at the time. But obviously that game got called off. I can't remember the exact details around it, but certainly we were due to play Argentina and there was controversy at the time.
Yeah, and I remember reading that Owen rang Ron Atkinson to ask for a player to be released, and Ron Atkinson told him to fuck off. You are not getting players to go play Argentina. So I think he got that from a lot of managers, and I think that probably set the tone for for what was happening with that Argentina game. So it's a bit of a shambles, I suppose, in terms of everything, the football, etc. But it got worse against Trinidad and Tobago, it's fair to say.
Yeah, it did. I mean, look, we started off with a 1-0 defeat in Chile. There's no shame in that. Losing 7-0, even to the Brazilian team of Zico, Socrates, Eder, etc., was pretty embarrassing. But then we went to Trinidad and Tobago, and we actually played two games on that tour. One of them, which is probably forgotten, it's not an official international. But unfortunately, we lost 2-1 to Trinidad and Tobago, which at the time, and maybe even still, is one of our more embarrassing defeats and one of our most embarrassing of all time, even allowing for the shambolic organization. That was a pretty bad defeat.
It's quite an extraordinary tour in terms of that. We're back then to qualifying for the Euros then for 84. This is in 1982. That campaign, I suppose, how does it go?
Yeah, it was one of those campaigns that was nearly over before it began. You know, we started off, we lost 2-1 to the Dutch in Rotterdam. And it was a bit of a disappointing defeat. Having drawn a year earlier, we thought we might have gone there again and got a result. That was not to be. We beat Iceland at home. And then we had Spain at home in late 1982. It was November 1982. And even at that stage, we had Iceland and Malta in the group. But effectively, it was going to be between ourselves, the Spanish and the Dutch, and there was only one to qualify. So the European Championships, there were only seven places with the French. So only the top team was going to qualify. So it was already, if you lose your opening match, you're already behind the eight ball. We had the Spanish at home. Ashley Grimes put us ahead early on, but Spain came back and they were beating us 3-1 in the second half. And my memory is Kevin O'Callaghan was out of this world. And he was destroying the Spanish left back. But we came back to draw 3-3, but it was already, we were already in big trouble at that stage. You can talk to Owen about that campaign, but it felt like even by the end of 1982 that our chances of qualifying were very slim. And as we go into 83, unfortunately, that's the way it proved to be.
And I just wanted to chat with you, just kind of, it's a slight tangent, but in terms of what points were for back then, we're not in 3 points for a win land anymore. It's 2 points for a win and one for a draw. Yeah. So your margin for error in terms of your ability to recover from a draw or defeat is much lower, isn't it?
Yeah, there isn't much. I mean, if you're in a, what effectively would become a three-team group, you'd expect everyone to beat Iceland home and away in those days and beat Malta home and away. So I suppose even if it's 3 points for a win or 2 points for a win, if you've lost away to the Dutch and drawn at home with the Spanish, you nearly had to beat Spain away and beat the Dutch in Dublin. And even still, that might not be enough.
And we subsequently lose to Spain and we lose to the Netherlands at home as well. Is it frustration? Is there a belief that we could have done more, or is that we're just kind of sitting there going, well, we had Spain and the Netherlands and that's that. That's essentially that.
Yeah, I mean, I should point out actually in March 83, 1-0 might maybe not right like to recall, but we played Malta, and I talked about Trinidad and Tobago being embarrassing. We were seconds away from an even more embarrassing draw with Malta.
That's right, yeah.
Now, it was on a terrible pitch, but Frank Stapleton backheeled a 90th-minute winner, a last-gasp winner. And I mean, I remember it wasn't even covered on RT television. I remember listening to the radio and going nuts at home in the kitchen because we got out of jail that day. But it was only a reprieve of a month. We went to play Spain in Zaragoza, and as I said, it was must win. But it wasn't to be. We were well beaten. We were beaten 2-0. There was no hard luck stories or anything like that. And that was, once we had lost to the Spanish, that was the end of the campaign. We did, as you say, we can talk about the Dutch in Dalymount Park. It was kind of, that was the end of the campaign as such. We actually led the Dutch 2-0 the following autumn. I think Lansdowne Road was being redeveloped. I think we're building the East Stand, so the game was switched to Dalymount. But I mean, the goal scorers, a guy by the name of Ruud Gullit had played against us in Rotterdam, but they had a couple of goal scorers that meant nothing to most fans at the time. And Ruud Gullit, I think, got two, and Marco van Basten got one. They came back to beat us 3-2, and obviously they went on to be absolute superstars, but I don't think anybody in Dublin at the time realised the talent that was coming through in Dutch football. The other thing about that campaign was it was quite controversial, because that win in Dublin should have set the Dutch up to qualify, but Spain beat Malta by some incredible scoreline to knock the Dutch out on goal difference. It didn't go down. It didn't matter to us, of course, but it didn't go down well at the time.
Yeah. So where are we now with Owen's kind of managership? Is it what's the reaction? Do we know about how he's managing the team? Where we're going? Because we're coming off the back of another disappointing campaign after being so close before, and a bit of a disaster of a tour. So what's the thoughts on Owen at this stage? Do we know?
So obviously, I am trying to remember. I'm doing this from memory a little bit. So, and I should point out, we did beat Malta 8-0 in a record win. So Owen is responsible for our record ever win. That campaign would have been seen, I think it's fair to say, as a disappointment. So he had been very unlucky, if not cheated out of a spot in the 82 World Cup. Even though it was Spain and the Netherlands, it was seen as a disappointment that we didn't really contend to qualify. But I don't remember his position being under threat. And there was still high hopes that we could make it to Mexico 86. We still had some talented players. And so it wasn't doom and gloom by any means, but I think it was certainly coming up to a defining moment when we were heading to for the 86 World Cup.
Before we get to the qualifiers for the 86 World Cup, I wanted to ask you something that's kind of somewhere in between there. We play China in Japan in the Japan Cup. What is that, and why are we there?
No, it's, I think it was called, was it the Kirin Cup in Japan? So we actually played more games than China, but the only one that's recognized as an official international was a 1-0 win over China in the semi-final of the tournament. Eamon O'Keefe, I think, got the goal. So it was a tournament, it was a bit of a strange one. We played some Brazilian club sides, and there was a group stage, so we got to the semi-finals. We beat China, and I can't remember actually the name of the Brazilian club side that beat us. I'm pretty sure it was a Brazilian side beat us in the final. So it was a Kirin Cup, Japan Cup. It was played every year. I think Scotland actually played in it a couple of times, and other clubs and national teams played in it. So I don't know how it came about. Maybe it's one to ask Owen, but the only official international was the semi-final win over China. But we played a few games in that cup, and the final, so we recognized the semi-final because we played the Chinese national team, but because we didn't play another national team in the tournament, they're not considered as full internationals.
Yeah, we played, I just looked at it there, we played Internacional in the final.
Ah, okay, right.
But that is definitely a bizarre one that popped up. But back to this 86, Mexico 86 qualifying campaign. Not a great start.
We actually made a fantastic start.
Yeah, we played, excuse me, go on.
Yeah, so we played the Soviet Union in September 84, and they were a top team with some really quality players, and they went on actually to make quite an impact in Mexico 86. But we played them in Dublin, Mickey Walsh with the goal. I talked about hard luck stories in the past. I suppose I should be fair and honest. We were certainly blessed to beat them that day. It was a fantastic performance. We played really well. Even though it was far from a full house, it was a fantastic atmosphere. I mean, we were buzzing that day. The Soviets hit the bar. They hit the post later on. They'll probably feel they deserved at least a point. But it was a fantastic win. Brilliant start. And we felt walking out of Lansdowne Road, we're going to Mexico, because that was an absolutely massive win. They were seen at the time as being the big team in the group. So it was seen as we had the likes of obviously Denmark in the group, but they had done well in Euro 84, but they weren't seen as big a threat as the Soviets. And Norway and Switzerland weren't considered to be that much of a threat at the time either. So to win the opening game against the Soviets was a huge boost and a brilliant start. And things were really looking up at that stage. And then, as you say, it went totally, totally wrong.
Yeah, it's kind of a thing in Irish football, isn't it? That we have that one fantastic result, like the one that really sets you up and you think, yeah, this is it, this is the time. And then we just can't follow it up. And we just didn't against Norway and Denmark, did we?
No, and I mean, the first one, Norway in particular, Norway were not a good side in those days. We would have been expected to go there and win. I think we had some injury issues. I think Liam Brady mightn't have been fully fit. We were beaten 1-0. Very, very disappointing result. The media didn't spare the team and Owen afterwards. There was a lot of criticism of the performance of the result. It was a bitter disappointment. A month later, we went to Copenhagen. It was a really, really strong and a really good Danish team. They were the coming team. The likes of Preben Elkjær scored a couple of goals against them. I think Michael Laudrup would have been in the team, Søren Lerbu, etc. There were some fantastic Danish players at the time. They beat us 3-0. We were absolutely walloped in the rain. And no complaints. We were just totally outclassed in Copenhagen. And at that stage, we still felt we were in contention. There were still possibilities, but things were looking pretty bleak at that stage.
Yeah, and they don't get much better than when we draw with Norway in Dublin. And it's fair to say that's probably that, isn't it?
The Norway game was... It's up there in some of the most embarrassing results of all time. So and it wasn't helped that we played in a new strip and it was never seen again. Actually, I know for those who collect Irish shirts, it's probably the holy grail of Irish jerseys. So it was a green shirt with a gold or a yellow stripe across the front, a bit like a Kerry GAA jersey. But we drew 0-0 at home to Norway. And I think the reason, I can't remember the journalist's name, but I think the reason the shirt was never seen again was because a journalist the following day said the yellow stripe on the shirt should have been down the players' backs.
Oh, absolute burn.
It was humiliating. But I mean, the performance was absolutely shocking. We drew 0-0 at home to Norway and... That was ironically, we actually followed it up with a 3-0 thrashing of Switzerland a couple of weeks later, which was a really impressive win. But I think the damage had been done. I probably should actually mention a day in Cork as well, because we hadn't played a home match. up to 1985, we had played one home game outside of Dublin, which was the famous Hungary game in the Mardyke in 1939. But Spain, as part of the Cork 800 celebrations, we played Spain in Fleur Lodge. And it was actually a huge occasion. I remember going to it with my dad and really enjoying it. We were just standing on the grass bank. There was a huge crowd there. Mm. I think, if I remember, we got absolutely soaked afterwards. A beautiful sunny summer's day, and suddenly the rain came from nowhere.
That's called a summer's day in Ireland.
Yeah, I suppose it is. But the rain came from nowhere, and there wasn't much. We weren't able to get stand tickets, I think, or whatever reason. We were certainly standing on the terraces. I know my dad would normally have tried to get stand tickets if he could, but the stand in Fleur Lodge was quite small in those days. But that was an unusual effort, an unusual way of seeing an Irish game for us a little bit closer to home. Obviously, just down the road in Cork instead of up in Dublin. But we did come back. We beat Switzerland 3-0. There was a scenario I remember going into that autumn. We had Switzerland away and the Soviets away and Denmark at home. And I think if we won all three games, we could still qualify for Mexico by whatever way the other results had panned out in the group. But we drew 0-0 in Switzerland, couldn't get the winner, and that was it. Beaten 2-0 by the Soviets. Well beaten. And then, we'll talk about Owen's last game.
Yeah, it's a home game against Denmark. And I that's what I was going to ask. Is this the game that that's it for Owen?
Yes, I think definitely. I mean, you'll obviously get a far better perspective from Owen himself, but I think the feeling among the fans was that his time was up, even coming into the Denmark game. But certainly after it was game over, it was lights out. So a couple of things in the run-up to the game. I think it was Raymond Smith, the journalist. Again, I could be wrong, but he was slagging off Mick McCarthy and saying he wasn't able to run and he was too slow. And what transpired is, I think, if I remember correctly, before the game, there was a challenge of a race. And although Mick McCarthy won the race easily, if I remember correctly, I think he pulled his hamstring and missed the game.
Good Lord.
That wasn't a good start. There was a very small crowd in Lansdowne Road. There was a huge Danish travelling support. And they needed a draw to win to qualify for the World Cup. They did qualify for the World Cup that day. I can't remember exactly what they needed. Certainly they had no trouble in getting what they needed. But one of the promotions from a Danish travel agency was, if you booked a trip to Dublin and Denmark won by 3 goals, your trip was free.
Oh.
Now, that would have been highly, I mean, we were tough to beat at home. So we hadn't been beaten in Lansdowne Road. Okay, we'd lost to the Dutch in the previous campaign, but we hadn't been beaten in a competitive match in Lansdowne Road for quite a while going back. I mean, I'm trying to think out loud here. I think it might have been Italy in 71 had been the last team to beat us in Lansdowne Road. We'd lost it as Dutch, I said, in Daly Mount. We were tough to beat at home. We'd beaten the Soviets. We'd drawn with Norway. We'd beaten, we'd hammered the Swiss 3-0. So Denmark, it was going to be a tough game for Denmark to beat us. They weren't expected to come and beat us. But Danish travel agent said, if they win by 3 clear goals, your trip is free. And the Danish travel agent lost a lot of money because Denmark came and beat us 4-1, absolutely battered us. And there was no way back for Owen after that. And that was, as I said, his last game.
If we reflect upon then the managership then of Owen at an international level, how do we look at it? Again, not unlike other Irish managers before, you know, so close yet so very far away. So how do we reflect on it in terms of what it brought to Ireland?
I think, look, he was very much the nearly man or the unluckiest man in Irish football. I mean, 82, there was bad luck, but there was also some disgraceful refereeing decisions. I mean, we were robbed. I think we did deserve to qualify for that World Cup. And when you look at how well the likes of Belgium in their first match beat Argentina, the world champions. The French went on to the semi-finals. They did so well. I mean, we were really unlucky to have such a strong group. The runners-up in the previous two tournaments finished below us in the group. The Dutch didn't qualify for 82. It could have been so different for him. I mean, had he brought us to that World Cup, it would have been a first ever major finals.
It could have been the turning point that Euro 88 was, couldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we had some fantastic players in Euro 88, but we equally so in 82. We had Liam Brady in his prime. We had Mark Lawrenson in his prime. Frank Stapleton, David O'Leary, etc., Gerry Daly, Tony Grealish, Dave Langan. We had, and I'm forgetting some, sorry, Michael Robinson obviously coming through. We had a fantastic side that could have done really well. I mean, instead of going to play Trinidad and Tobago, and instead of going to Uberlandia, we actually lost to Algeria in the run-up to the 82 World Cup as well. That would be a fantastic trip today as well. But instead of playing games like that, we would have been preparing to go to Spain. And what a fantastic tournament that would have been to qualify. I mean, we looked on in envy as Northern Ireland went to Spain and beat the hosts. I mean, I remain convinced we had a better team at the time than Northern Ireland. I know I get a lot of criticism with a lot of Northern Ireland fans. They'd be very, very unhappy with that comment. And I know I appreciate they had a fantastic team and they had a fantastic World Cup and some wonderful players as well. But so had we. And I think we were really unlucky not to go there. And I think we would have made an impact in that World Cup as well.
Absolutely, yeah. And we've come to the end of Owen Hand's reign. And I think in the next episode of Irish Internationals, we're going to be talking about the incredible story that was to come and Jack Charlton. But let's not give away too much because it's the greatest story in international Irish international football. But until then, Gary, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Well, that's it for this week's show. You can subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you listen to us on, whether it's Spotify, Apple, Amazon Music, or YouTube Podcast and more. You can find us there. Share the show on your social media as well and help us spread the word about the podcast and, of course, Irish footballing history. And remember to support your local League of Ireland and Northern Ireland Football League club. It's our heritage. It's our game. Bye for now.